Appreciate you calling in, and I know you have a proposal that you've put out on some changes to the taxation program of West Virginia that holds some possibilities of being a fairer approach and may save the taxpayers of West Virginia some money. So be happy to hear you comment on what I just was talking about, and go ahead with your proposal as you wish.
Okay. Well, the proposal that I put out there was actually driven less by an issue of fairness than it was by the fact that in West Virginia, especially when we're trying to wrestle with a deficit right now, the legislature has a real potential opportunity to change the tax structure in a way that will inject a lot of money into the state that would create a lot of jobs and a lot of prosperity around the state. And that's by shifting a lot of the tax burden that currently falls on West Virginia residents in the form of the income and the sales tax, and shift it to other kinds of taxes like property taxes that hit a large number of out-of-state interests who hold large, large tracts of property in West Virginia. In other words, by shifting the tax burden to taxes that hit people who are out of state to a larger degree than the income tax and sales tax do, we could accomplish two things simultaneously. One is we could fix the budget deficit with which West Virginia is struggling now and that is getting rapidly worse. And at the same time, we could put into the pockets of virtually all West Virginia taxpayers a huge tax cut that on average would come to about $1,800 a year per family in West Virginia.
Well, that's not chicken feed.
No, it isn't. In fact, I mean, it would not only be by far the largest tax cut that has ever been enacted in West Virginia, but overall, it would be about $1.25 billion being injected into the state's economy, which would have a huge impact on commerce and jobs and prosperity. The other thing that I think people will appreciate about this is that what it's really doing is recapturing more of the wealth that is created by West Virginia labor and West Virginia resources and keeping it in the state. And that, I think, is something that pretty much everybody could rally around, especially since doing this would raise the average income of West Virginians by almost 5%.
Okay. And how would your proposal work?
The shift would be from right now, we have a variety of taxes from which the state derives its revenue. The two largest taxes that we have out there are the personal income tax and the consumer sales tax. And then along with that, we have a variety of other taxes, including corporate taxes, the severance tax, of course, on natural gas and coal and other sources of revenue. But those two taxes, the consumer sales tax and the income tax, generate almost three-quarters of the revenue that West Virginia generates. And both of those taxes are paid either almost exclusively or in large part by West Virginia residents, West Virginia taxpayers. On the other hand, the state currently has no statewide property tax. And the difference between on the one hand, the income tax and the sales tax, which are paid almost entirely by West Virginia residents, is that in West Virginia, a property tax would hit a number of out-of-state people because huge tracts of West Virginia property are owned by out-of-state entities. In fact, the most recent data that's available suggests that about two-thirds of all the privately held property in West Virginia is owned by out-of-state interests and individuals. And so consequently, if you were to replace the income tax and the sales tax with the property tax, a much larger share of that property tax would fall on out-of-state interests who derive a great deal of value from West Virginia, but frankly pay very little for it. And by making that shift, what would happen is that whereas right now West Virginians pay about a combined 90% or so of the state income tax and the state sales tax, their burden under the state property tax would drop from 90% down to about 50%, the other 40% being shifted outside the state. And so consequently, the state would get just as much revenue as it always does. There would be no cut in services or other compromises to try to deal with budget deficits. But at the same time, West Virginia residents would see their taxes reduced significantly, and to the tune of about $660 per person, or about $1,800 per year per West Virginia family. And that's enough money to make a huge difference economically in this state.
Have you looked at some of the profiles of different situations to examine how this would affect individual cases?
No, I really haven't gone that deeply, although there are a couple of points that I can make in that regard. The first one is that when you consider one of the sources of objection to this is very likely to come from the business lobby, who would be concerned that, you know, a tax that hit out-of-state interests might discourage business people or business investment in the state. One of the interesting things about it is that if you're a West Virginia business owner, although your taxes may go up as a result of this as a business owner, your taxes as a West Virginia resident, your personal taxes, would in all likelihood come down by much more than your business taxes would go up. And so even West Virginia merchants would see, not all of them, but the vast majority of them would see a great improvement in their tax situations because of this. The other concern that I think is likely to arise would actually come from the other end of the political spectrum, and that is that a property tax is not progressive in the way an income tax is. And the concern would be that a lot of lower income West Virginians would be hit by this tax. And to that, and I think that's a legitimate concern. And so one of the things the state might want to do in enacting this kind of a tax would be to incorporate an upfront exclusion of a certain amount of property, maybe $50,000 or the first $100,000 would not be affected by this tax, which would insulate lower income West Virginians against the consequences of this and make the tax effectively progressive.
Mm-hmm. I guess the one thing that comes to my mind that I would be interested to see how you might look at this would be people who have property but don't have a lot of income. So they might have a hard time paying a tax like that. I don't know if there's a lot of people in that category, but I can imagine there are. There are some, at least. I just wondered how you would react to that one.
Well, and that's why, Joe, I suggested that if we had an upfront exclusion of a certain amount of property, it would insulate many, many of those people from being unduly burdened by this. So, you know, it's in any tax situation, there are clearly going to be winners and losers.
Right.
And, you know, that has to be acknowledged up front. But we're probably talking about more than 90% of West Virginians would see their taxes greatly reduced in this scenario, mm-hmm. and by a lot.
Have other states adopted this type of a plan?
Well, it's interesting. I was looking at that. I don't know of any that have done a complete about-face in the way that I'm suggesting West Virginia should. But on the other hand, I was just looking at some data last night. And interestingly, of the 10 states in the United States that have the lowest rates of state taxation, six of them are also in the top 10 for the degree to which they export their tax burden to out-of-state interests. And what's even more interesting is that many of those states, like Texas, Alaska, Wyoming, are states that, like West Virginia, are very rich in natural resources and have huge extractive industries, the oil and gas industry in Texas and Louisiana, the mining industry in Wyoming, and, of course, oil in Alaska. And so you can almost see a template out there for West Virginia for how it's done. Those states all, again, have among the lowest state tax loads in the United States. And in every case, these are states that also do an extremely effective job of exporting their taxes because they have natural resource and extractive industry base to be able to do so. In fact, it's almost scandalous that West Virginia isn't in that list, because clearly there's a template for how we could be and how we could achieve those same kinds of tax savings.
Right, and it kind of strikes me that at this point, when our biggest resource has in the past been coal, and now that is declining, it seems we kind of missed the boat on this one, and we should have had this thing in place a long time ago. And now I wonder, with the dwindling coal resources, what's going to happen with our people. What are these holdings of property is what I wonder. Are these for the purpose of fossil fuel removal, or are these, what's the nature of these holdings of property, I wonder?
Much of them is forest land. The single largest property owner in West Virginia is a cooperative organization, based in North Carolina, that has hundreds of thousands of acres in the state. And also, of course, there are coal interests, which have huge swaths of property. And one of the difficult aspects of this is a lot of property in West Virginia sits in fairly undeveloped form, and there's very little incentive, because taxation rates are so low on that property, there's very little incentive for the holders of that property to put it into commerce and to develop it at all. And one of the effects of enacting a property tax to replace a sales and income tax is that it would actually create an incentive for owners to either do something with that property or sell it to somebody who would. And while I consider myself to be a pretty avid environmentalist and conservationist, I don't think there's any doubt that, West Virginia needs to generate more wealth for its people. And one of the ways in which it could do it is by being able to have lots of the property that right now sits completely unused for any purpose whatsoever, and have it transferred into commerce, where it could actually become the source of productive activity and wealth.
Kind of reminds me of a gentleman named Henry George.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that one?
Yep.
Okay.
Go
ahead.
The idea, Joe, in a real world, it is a pretty radical idea. It's a stretch. I know when Ted Bettner of the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy saw this, and he retweeted the article that we're talking about today. He described it as a great example of out-of-the-box thinking, which is probably a polite way of saying, this probably isn't going to happen. But at the same time, what I'm hoping the article will do by pointing out that there's as much as $1.25 billion that could be put in the pockets of West Virginians, I'm hoping that it will at least cause the state legislature, as they go through the tax reform process that's taking place right now, to begin to think about taxes and different schemes in terms of how they affect West Virginians versus non-residents. Because, you know, a lot of times when we hear people talk about tax debates, you know, we hear about the effect on business, or we hear about how taxes affect the rich versus the poor, or the rich versus the middle class. But one of the divides that you almost never hear anybody talk about is how different tax schemes affect residents versus non-residents. And the point that I'm trying to make by pointing out there's a $1.25 billion on the table is that the resident-non-resident divide is a very, very important one. And so whether the legislature were to adopt something like what I'm proposing or pursue something that they're more inclined to do, I hope that legislators will start to evaluate those other options, in part at least, on the basis of do they shift the tax burden more heavily onto West Virginians, or do they relieve some of the tax burden on West Virginians? Because in all of the recent tax reform that West Virginia has done, which has consisted heavily of reducing business taxes, one of the effects of that is that we have been loading more and more and more of the tax burden onto West Virginia residents and removing it from people who live out of state. And that's a shame, because when we send tax savings to Walmart or to any out-of-state entity, that tax savings leaves West Virginia entirely. It's no longer part of the state's economy. Whereas when West Virginians keep the money in their pockets, when the tax savings go to West Virginians, that money goes directly into our economy, and it helps West Virginia merchants and enriches us all. And so my hope is that by pointing out how much money is at stake and what could be done, when legislators think about how they want to revise the tax code, they'll begin to consider whether or not they're exporting money out of the state or keeping money in the state and enriching our economy.
Right, and I think it does put a fair amount of pressure on the legislators to respond to the question, why are you standing up for the out-of-staters rather than your own residents? And we're going to quickly see the power of the out-of-state property holders come to bear against these legislators.
Oh, absolutely. If this battle were actually joined, then yes, you would see that dividing line emerge immediately, and it would be a really interesting one. I mean, I am encouraged somewhat. I have gotten notes back about the article from Jeff Kessler, who's a Democrat running for the nomination for governor, and also Stephen Skinner from the Eastern Panhandle has mentioned it too, and I know the article's been retweeted also by Chris Regan, who's, I think, vice chairman of the Democratic Party in West Virginia. So I know people are at least paying attention to it, which is encouraging.
When is the time frame under which this would come before the legislature or be considered by the budget planning folks?
Well, I don't know that in the form I suggested it ever will be, but there is a legislative task force that's right now working to come up with tax reform proposals because, as I said, you know, we're facing a really awful budget deficit this year, largely due to a force you mentioned, which is the plunge in prices of the natural gas industry. And so the task force, are planning to come back at the beginning of the year in the next session of the legislature with a series of recommendations, which from all the reporting that I've seen so far, it looks as though it's going to be more of what we've seen in the recent past, which will be attempts to reduce business taxes while probably combining that with, you know, some fairly serious cuts in services, more hiring freezes, and more things of that sort. And, you know, the tragedy is that if we do more of the same, which, as I said before, has been to cut taxes on business, export tons of money out of the state while enacting hiring freezes and cuts in state services, we're actually contributing to the loss of money from West Virginia's economy and to reductions in the number of jobs in the state, this is an opportunity where we could actually turn that dynamic around. And so, you know, we'll begin to see come the first of the year, as the Tax Reform Committee starts submitting proposals to the state legislature, whether or not they're going to take some of these issues into account and try to do something about them.
And I guess that would depend partly on to what extent the politicians that are running for office this year and next year are going to pick this up and start adding it to their platform.
That it would be fun if they did. I mean, I think personally, I think this is a good case where this isn't only good policy, but it's also good politics, because it allows you, among other things, as a candidate, if you were to take up this cause, it allows you to people to appeal not just to people's sense of what's good government and what's fair, but also to self-interest, because, as I said, we're talking about being able to, on average, put about $1,800 a year in the pockets of West Virginia families. And so I would think, as a politician, that would be an especially appealing offer to be able to make, especially when you combine it with the fact that, again, we're not talking about sucking money out of people who are out of state. What we're talking about doing is simply retaining more of the wealth that's created by West Virginia resources and West Virginia labor in West Virginia. This is wealth that we as a state created. It's wealth that we as a state should be able to retain, or should want to retain as much of as we can.
Right. Well, it certainly is anachronistic that a state with so much in the way of resources is so impoverished, and that's exactly, I think that's exactly where you're coming to bear on the situation, because, you know, I think it's very similar to foreign countries that have extractive industry and the impoverishment of their people in the face of a few wealthy, and in this case, they're living out of state. So, you know, there's quite a fairness issue involved here, I think, as well.
Yeah, there is, and so, you know, I'm somewhat hopeful that at least the issue will start showing up on the radar screens of some of the folks who are in a position to make decisions about this, and that, yeah, perhaps some candidates will begin to take up this cause as a part of their platforms for running for office.
Yeah, I would like to see that.
Yeah.
Well, good talking with you, and I've got a couple minutes left. I mentioned to you that I was interested, and we don't have a lot of time to go into it very deeply, but you are kind of a little different in the way you go about your proposals, your analysis, your writing. It's all based largely on empirical, statistical data and your analysis of data. And I wondered if you would make a comment or two about your underlying approach and how you go about your research.
Well, sure. I suppose I should mention that when I first started writing about West Virginia about 6 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago now, one of the reasons that I did it was because I noticed that there was just consistently a gap between the rhetoric that you would hear from politicians, particularly with respect to the state's economy, and just the, you know, the manifest reality that you could see if you drove around or lived in the state. And so I got curious about it and started looking things up. And, you know, there is, of course, a vast array of statistical resources out there that allow you to pretty much come to a sound statistical understanding of what's going on at West Virginia that pretty often conflicts with the anecdotal stuff that you hear from politicians about, you know, we're creating jobs, or the natural gas industry is generating prosperity in northern West Virginia. You can go to sources like the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy. You can go to the West Virginia Commerce Department's Workforce West Virginia website. There's the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis database of economic information and other sources that simply allow you pretty quickly to see what the statistical reality is in the state as compared to the rhetoric that you hear from politicians. And so typically what I do is when I hear a politician or business person making a claim about the great things that are happening in West Virginia, I generally just turn around and go check the corresponding statistics to see whether or not that's true. And to a large degree, in the first couple of years that I was writing, I spent a great deal of time pointing out that the claims for the benefits that were being generated from the natural gas industry were vastly overstated in terms of the jobs that were being created and the commerce that it was generating. And, you know, it's sad that it didn't turn out to match the claims that people were making for the industry, but I do take some pride in the fact that, you know, here we are 7 years on in the fracking boom in West Virginia, and in fact, what I was pointing out 6 and 7 years ago has so far proven to be the case, which is that West Virginia has received almost no economic benefit, at least as measured by jobs or commerce, from the fracking boom. And so I think, you know, in a state that's dominated by coal and gas and extractive industries, and that, as you pointed out a minute ago, is one of the most impoverished in the nation, it's incredibly important that we start checking the rhetoric that we hear from the industries and from politicians that follow the industry and balancing it against the actual reality, because clearly we have not been well served by those industries and those people.
Right, and I think a lot of people are grateful to have you, that we rely on the people that are interested in facts. And, you know, it's funny, they used to say facts are a troubling thing, that people don't seem to be as troubled by facts as they used to be, but their day may come back again. There certainly are a reservoir of people that still want to hear the facts. So we're grateful to have you out there doing this kind of work, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the show, too.
Well, I enjoy doing it, and I'm glad to have people like you available to come on and make these kind of discussions. Thank you so much, Sean. Appreciate talking with you. Best of luck to you.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Been talking with Sean O'Leary, who's had many years here in West Virginia, now living out on the West Coast, but he still keeps an eye on good old West Virginia and takes care of us. So follow his blog, The State of My State. He's written a book and he keeps a blog up, so check him out, Sean O'Leary, State of the State. Thank you all very much for listening in to Seven Generations Radio. Hope you have a great week. It's a beautiful day, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another show. Thank you very much.